Welcome to Radio Tabule, fresh content west of the Middle East, the weekly podcast brought to you by the Levantine Cultural Center. Based in Los Angeles, the center promotes a greater understanding of the Middle East and North Africa with artistic and educational programs that bridge political and religious divides. Dr. Manaz Mona Afridi teaches Judaism and Islam at Antioch University in Los Angeles. She's originally from Pakistan. She was raised in Europe and the Middle East. But she brings a real multicultural perspective to Islam. Her deep interest in Judaism and modern Jewish diaspora has led her to numerous interfaith conferences and invitations by non-Muslims to expound on the intellectual and theological similarities between Jews and Muslims. She's presented a talk called An Illuminated History of Jewish-Muslim Relations at Levantine Cultural Center, and you can visit her website at manazafridi.com. My interview with Manaz took place on January 7th, 2010. Jordan O'Brien, I'm with the Levantine Cultural Center, and I'm here with Manaz Afridi, who is actually a member of our National Advisory Board. And Manaz is a scholar of both Islam and Judaism, and we became friends several years ago, and I am really interested to know what it is that has attracted you as a scholar of Islam to know so much about Judaism and the Holocaust, and just explain to me how you got interested in all this.
Well, Jordan, it's a complicated story. It's personal, it's intellectual, and it's political. When I was born in Pakistan, we moved when I was about 5 years old to Zurich, then to London, then to Geneva, and then we ended up in the Middle East, Dubai, and then I came to New York and I stayed here. my experience as a Muslim in Europe, especially in Western Europe, was very unique, because at that time in the 70s, there weren't a lot of Muslims living in these places, nor were they at private good schools. And my only connection with people in school were with primarily Jews, Indians, meaning Hindus, and the Christians or the Catholics were basically the majority. So I ended up befriending and being befriended by Jews and Hindus. And so that really shaped my experience in terms of child. And then when I ended up in the Middle East, it was the opposite. Everyone was Christian or Muslim, and there were no Jews or Hindus. So as a child, you start to question, well, what happened to these connections that I made as a young child in Europe? And one day, when I was in Dubai, going to a school in Sharjah called School of Shoifat, that actually was a Lebanese school that was moved there in the 80s because of the war with Israel and Lebanon, my supervisors came into the classroom during a geography and history class and started to rip out parts of the textbook that had the word Israel in it. And everyone seemed kind of okay with this. And I was very disconcerted because I didn't understand it. Nobody explained it to me. And I asked some of the friends in my class, what's going on? They said, oh, it's just Israel. You know, they don't want us to read the word and it's political. So I went home and I asked my mother, what's going on? She said, well, you know, nothing, Israel is a political entity and we don't recognize it. And I said, well, what about Jews? And she goes, Jews are okay. We accept Judaism. And then 3 years later, I moved to New York. I moved to an area, Scarsdale, New York, which is a very upper class area, predominantly Jewish and Protestant. I went to Scarsdale High School, and as my parents and I and my brother moved to a house, renting it, we started to get harassing calls. And the harassing calls were basically, you effing Arabs, move out of our place, get the hell out. And it just continued and continued and continued. So my father called the police, and the police identified a lot of Jewish callers because it was the first time they had seen Muslims living in this area. So I became very confused, but at the same time very intrigued by this problem, because I felt that there was something I was not grappling with, that I was not understanding about my own identity or my own religion. And when I went to college, I didn't really address it. I just studied literature and psychology and experienced college in terms of the American experience.
And where was this?
At Syracuse University, upstate New York. And then I declared religion a major my junior year, and I had a English major. And then it wasn't until I was a graduate student where I took made a teaching assistant with Dr. Alan Berger, who was teaching post-Holocaust studies. And I didn't just become a teaching assistant, I became a student of his in the sense that I started to understand what the Shoah was, the Holocaust. I started to understand what the creation of Israel was about. I started to understand the tension between Arabs and Jews, Muslims and Jews. I began to do a lot of research on my own. And then one day, he said, I was given the best assistant award, and he came to me and said, "Why don't you go to Israel?" And I looked at him and I said, "I can't go to Israel. I have a Pakistani passport." He said, "Don't worry. If you really want to go to Israel, apply for a grant at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and I'll make it happen." And he gave me some forms, and I walked home from the office to my little apartment, and somehow it just was the most exciting prospect for me. I applied and I got the grant, and I told my family, my friends, "I'm going to Israel." And they just said, "I'm absolutely nuts. Why are you going to go to Israel?" I said, "Because I want to know what this dispute is about."
The dispute meaning the Israeli-Palestinian dispute.
Israeli-Palestinian dispute. But more so, deeply, why Israel was being censored from me. Why I didn't get the news in certain parts. Why Jews didn't like Arabs. I mean, there's lots of looming questions for me. And I had known Jews, I had known Arabs, I had known Muslims, and I couldn't understand it. So I went to Hebrew University, and I took a class called Biblical Archaeology, because when you're young, you want to know where origins are. So I try to understand, you know, was this the Jewish line? Was this the Palestinian land? The class was really irrelevant, but the experience was the most powerful thing for me, because as a Pakistani passport holder, I was allowed to go into the Palestinian territories when everyone was taking their naps, and I was allowed to be in Israel, in proper Israel. So I got a completely different experience, which was ultimately both Palestinians and Israelis wanted peace. And how you make peace is the important thing. And how you fear one another was the important thing. And I came back in love with Jerusalem, in love with the Wailing Wall and the Masjid al-Aqsa, and in love with the Dome of Rock, and in love with even Bethlehem. And when I came back, I just thought, okay, well, that was an interesting experience. I pursued my PhD. I decided to write my PhD in literature because I felt that narratives were more important. And Nafi Mahfouz was somebody who told stories of ordinary people at that time, and I picked him up.
Nagi Mahfouz being the Egyptian novelist. And was this before or after he won the Nobel Prize?
After. And I wanted to tell a story about Islam through narrative. My initial idea was to write my dissertation on Jewish and Islamic literature, but my university, which is in South Africa, did not want to comply by that. But that's a long story. But I'm really glad I did this dissertation. But on the master's level, I did so much work in Judaism. I did my master's comprehension on the Exodus, which still happens to be my favorite part of...
Which Exodus? The Exodus that's in the Torah of the Jews in Egypt?
Yes. It's funny that you ask the question, which Exodus? To me, the Exodus is for all Jews, Christians, and Muslims, the same exodus. If you look at sacred texts, and you look at the Jewish Torah and the Book of Exodus, Book of Exile, basically, you look at Exodus in terms of what Christians today call the Old Testament, and if you look at the Quran, and you look at the kinds of stories and the exact same stories of Moses and Pharaoh exist, to me, it's the same Exodus. People may argue it differently for me, but even the Quran itself mentions the word Musa, Moses, many, many more times than Muhammad, and many, many more times than Abraham. Musa is a hero in the Quran. And he's a hero because he doesn't have the same ending as he does in the Torah, which is the promised land ending, which is he's never allowed to enter the promised land. In the Islamic text, he is celebrated as one of the first prophecies to actually talk directly in terms of people in history after Abraham about the concept of the one God.
He's one of the first prophets to talk about the concept of the one God.
After Abraham, yeah, right. Abraham.
Well, what about this this little hiccup that happened about a decade ago where they, some archaeologists did some work and it came out that, well, the Exodus might have never actually happened, that there weren't, the Jews may have not actually been slaves in Egypt. You know, there was something of a controversy, and in fact, it was Rabbi David Wolpe at the Sinai Temple was one of the first officials in the Jewish community here in L.A. to say, well, you know, the Exodus story, as we've been told it as Jews, may not exactly be correct.
Well, I mean, you know, Jordan, there are stories and there are stories, but there's sacred life and there's humanity. There was actually, along those lines, another fantastic documentary about how the miracles of Moses were maybe perhaps possible, but in translation came out to be real exaggerations. you know, if we look at history and we ask ourselves, well, you know, what stories were told? I come from essentially an oral tradition. Whether in my past life as a Pakistani, I was a Hindu converted to Islam, or a Christian, or a Jew, I was in some way, in some form, converted. Oral stories are magnificent, and I think part of sacred reality is part of oral reality, but also oral reality and written reality are completely separate acts. And when you question whether Moses was actually in Egypt, whether Jews were enslaved, you have to question, well, who's rewriting these stories? You know, I mean, Judaism 5,000 years ago, maybe 10, according to some. Christianity, 2,010 years ago, and in Islam, you know, 1,500 years ago, have the exact same stories.
Well, for me, that's because they're all based on pagan roots, you know, on Zoroastrian roots. An example of this for me is the end of Passover in Morocco. The Jews in Morocco celebrate something called Mimuna, which they open their homes up to all their neighbors, and all the Muslim neighbors come over to the Jews' houses in Morocco, and they bring over sweets and beer, all the things the Jews couldn't have. They bake this bread called moufleta, which is kind of like a thick pancake, like a crepe, mm-hmm. and they dip it in honey. And the Mimuna table has all this symbology, like a big fish, which symbolizes, you know, the spring, the new year, the fertility and abundance. And then you have these little gold coins, you know, chocolate that's covered with gold, and flowers, and just all these symbols. And the Iranians, for Nowruz, their new year, they have the Hafsin that the Iranians celebrate is a Zoroastrian tradition, which is all from the pagan era, right, before all of these religions. And it's the same setup, the same symbols as Mimuna. You know?
Well, I mean, I think even if you say they're pagan rituals, indigenous or whatever, I mean, And we've identified ourselves as monotheistic, one God believers. I think there's so much leakage and there's so much exchange and there's so much going on. I mean, for example, there's a person who seek me out, his name is Dr. Navras Afridi, same last name as mine, same tribe, who has written numerous papers about how Afridis are descendants of Jews because of them keeping kosher still to this day in the northwestern part of Pakistan, which is where all the trouble is, which is really interesting because if you look at what happened, that part in that part of the world was a lot of Jews did convert if they escaped to that part of the world, but they kept certain rituals. Whether it was Jewish, whether it was Zoroastrian, whether it was Hindu, these are not very important questions. What's important is that how, if we are Muslim and Jews, if we are Christians or Zoroastrians or Hindus, what we do with that in terms of humanity? That is the most important question. And if there are rituals that are left over from other traditions, it doesn't blow my mind. I mean, I am from Pakistan, and there are traditions in my country that maybe Saudi Arabians think it's completely blasphemous because they come from Hindu India, or Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia, and perhaps, you know, Moroccans think that's blasphemous what they do in Saudi Arabia. So there, even amongst Muslims, there are so many differences because of the imprints of so many cultures, and then the added problem of colonization, how different countries, Arabs and Muslims, reacted to colonization.
Well, you know, this mixing is something that interests me a lot. The idea of the family stories where you have intermarriages and you have conversions back and forth, and you know, and I found out, as you know, that the Agrabli family in Morocco was a Berber and Jewish, and then all the Agrablis in Fez are all Muslim now. They used to be Jews. And you know, you've written a paper that the Levantine Review is going to be publishing next month called Literature and the Foretaste for Cultural Islam. And you quote Edward Said, "No one today is purely one thing. Labels like Indian or woman or Muslim or American are not more than starting points, which if followed into actual experience for only a moment are quickly left behind. Imperialism consolidated the mixture of cultures and identities on a global scale." And, you know, I'm exploring, as you know, this theory of bricolage in terms of we don't have a core identity. We are this and that. We are multiple. We are many things. And that kind of goes against, I think, basic human nature, which is to be parochial and say, well, I'm an Iranian Shia, you know, and that's a very specific thing. People look for the specificity because it's simpler, right? It's easier to understand. But to be a Pakistani Muslim who embraces some of the tenets of Judaism, who knows Christianity, that's confusing for people. They're like, well, who is Menaz Afridi? I mean, how do we explain this? It's too complicated.
Actually, it's a very good question, Jordan. As a Muslim who believes in a personal spiritual practice, and I don't wear my Islam on my sleeve, and I don't do that because it's my personal relationship with God. But why it's an interesting question is that identity itself is what is the core of who you are, and race, religion, rituals and ideology are not. The core of who you are is what you do every day, how you act, what you do with your family, how you work, your ethics, where your money goes, how you act with your husband, your daughter, your son, your friends, who you let enter in your house, what you put in your house, what you put on the table, and where you are. That is the core of identity.
Well, granted, but of course, religious identity feeds into that, because if you're Jewish, then you have certain traditions and rituals and reservations. If you're Muslim, you have other ones. So your religious identity can't be separated from your identity.
Okay, that I don't completely agree with that, and I think that's what Said is talking about. Or Edmund Husserl talked about in terms of epoché. Edmund Husserl is a historian, and he said epoché is a moment in history where things break, which means you can be a Muslim, you can be a Jew, you can be a Christian, you can have those rituals, you can have Eid al-Fitr, you could have Eid al-Adha, you could have the Three Kings Day, for example. You can have Lent. You can have any of these rituals, but yet there is a moment where you decide what is more important to the other. And every religion, including Buddhism, Hinduism, Zoroastrianism, and Native American religions, talk about this notion of otherness. This is a fundamental concept in believing in the other, which essentially in Judaism and Islam especially is God. God is the unknowable, unimaginable. So when you let enter that imaginable in your house as a human being, you must revere that. That is the most important concept in terms of identity. So you're right, religious identity cannot be separated from your core identity. But at the same time, you have to decide, you have a mind and an intellect that is God-given. What have Muslims forgotten? Ilm, the first thing. What is the miracle of Islam? Writing, proclamation of what? Words, poetry. We have forgotten these things. This is our core. This is to speak. Ilm. Muhammad himself was a man of justice. He was a politician. We don't like to say that. Today we have a new celebration in Pakistan, which is commemorating his birthday and his death anniversary. These are commemorations that are not Islamic, but are ritualistic. So, I mean, what is different about Christmas? Nothing. We have now taken on the colonial gaze of commemorating the birth and death of Muhammad, just like Christ. So you have to make those decisions individually, and communities have to decide whether they want to be safe or want to take a risk in terms of their thinking and still maintain the fact that they're Muslims or Jews or Christians or Hindus or whatever. But for me, essentially, Islam is about justice. It's about thinking. It's about who we are as human beings. That the whole point of Islam, the whole point of Muhammad, was to bring egalitarianism into the world, to stop injustices towards slavery, women, in the 6th century.
This is great. It's wonderful, and I'm totally there with you. And if you know a lot about the tenets of Judaism, as you know, in the Torah and the Talmud, the arguments of the rabbis, Judaism is all about justice, and it's about making the world a better place, and it's about healing every day, tikkun olam, repairing the world. And yet we still have all of this animosity. You know, the story that you told about being in Scarsdale and the Jews not feeling comfortable with, you know, a new Muslim family in the neighborhood. And another story that we heard earlier about, you know, people in Pakistan who think that all the problems that they're having are, it's like a Jewish conspiracy. And, you know, quite often you hear that there's anti-Semitism in the Arab world, and they blame everything either on Israel or some Jewish conspiracy. And so these two religions, they have so much in common. It's so so beautiful and so evolved. And yet people, average people, have so much suspicion about one another, you know. And then you have the aberrations like you and me, who are natural bridge builders, who I don't see any difference between the two of us, you know. I'm an Arab Jew, so I've got I'm Jewish, but I've got Muslim relatives, and I, mm-hmm. and it's all good. You know, I could see all the similarities, but it's frustrating because as many bridges as we can build, they're out there destroying them every day. You know. So, look, in this piece that you're writing about Islamic culture and how dynamic it is and how it's changing all the time, you know, the clash of civilizations is an issue that comes up a lot. It's one of the things that it's one of the concerns that the programming of the Levantine Center addresses. You know, I don't think there is any clash of civilizations, but comment on that. You know, if we have you know, the East and the West, and there's still, I guess, the majority of society in the Arab Muslim world is still more traditional than we are here in the United States, you know, on many levels. You know, I almost think that it's almost like Egypt, Syria, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran. These societies are, here we are in the, you know, 21st century, it's 2010, and their way of living is maybe 20 years, 30 years behind what's going on in the United States in terms of how close the majority of the society is to being traditional in their religious habits.
You know, Jordan, I could write a dissertation just now about the differences between the mainstream, as we speak of it in the United States, and in these different countries that you mentioned. And I'll tell you why. I mean, I think, and I'm also going to address your prior question about, you know, so these traditions are so beautiful and so what the hell. But, I mean, I can get to that. But let me just get to your latter point. For me, being from Pakistan, being very privileged in my life, and then making my life on my own since my father passed, has shown me that the most important thing for Muslim countries today is economy. We in America are sitting, even the poorest person in this country, very privileged. And some of my American friends may get upset with me, but they have not lived elsewhere. They have no idea what it means to live in Pakistan, Bangladesh, Malaysia even. Absolutely no understanding of what is mainstream. What is mainstream here is completely different. And I think that's a very important conversation to have for people who are scholars of religion, scholars of history, for the Levantine Cultural Center. I mean, it's a very crucial discussion, which I will say even strongly for Muslim women. Muslim women have been oppressed by men because of economic reasons, because of the lack of literacy, because of the lack of access, because of lack of water for their kids. Very basic, essential needs. Religion is something that we study in the West. Speaking of clash of civilizations, religion is something we live in the East. That is a major difference. If Samuel Huntington and Bernard Lewis could understand lived experience versus studying experience, that we wouldn't have a clash of civilization.
I can understand this and explain it in a slightly different way, which is in the case of Jews and Judaism, you have the Eastern European or Ashkenazi Jews who went through a Reformation, mm-hmm. which started in Germany and then England and came to the United States. So in Judaism has formerly three official schools, the Reform Judaism, the Conservative, and then the Orthodox. And in Reform and Conservative, the women and the men can sit together, you know, in services. But in Orthodox Judaism, they can't. Now, in the Arab world, or in the Middle East, the Jews have Iran and Morocco, where my family's from, and all the other countries, they never had a Reformation. So the Sephardic observance of Judaism allows for people who pray daily and those who almost never go to synagogue, and they accept in Sephardic Jewish or Middle Eastern Jewish society all the variations of religious observance of piousness, and they don't make any separation between everyone's part of the community, and it's somehow kind of understood that you may be a big believer, you may be a small believer, but you're still part of the kind of almost like the ummah, you know, you're a part of the Jewish experience, whether you're a big believer and you're pious or you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a foreign concept here, you know, among Americans, because we have such a secular society. This is the distinction that I was trying to make. I was just saying, you know, the Arab Muslim world is not fundamentally a secular place. It's a place where everyone has some kind of connection to the sacred,
mm-hmm.
however profound, pious or not. It's sort of just understood.
Mm-hmm.
But here, no.
Exactly. And, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, I always tell my students this, and, you know, colleagues of mine, and we talk about this, is that there's actually no place in the Arab or Muslim world that has the Sharia law in place. I mean, we have, you know, different variations of the Sharia. For example, in Egypt, you have just family law and divorce law. That's Sharia. Everything else is, you know, parliamentary system. In Pakistan, you have just two laws that are Sharia. The rest is parliamentary system. Usually, they're about women and family and kids. So we are still, you know, sort of finding our place. And you talk about Reformation. You know, I think that Reformation in the Protestant sense was a very bloody, bloody, brutal thing. You know, when there was a Reformation in the Christian world, it was not a very beautiful picture. And when the United States was formed, it was not a beautiful picture. And when now, in our part of the world, Muslim, which is predominantly Asian, by the way, not Arab, I just have to correct everyone on that. And we are in ourselves having an issue because we're being asked, the majority of Muslims, what does this extremist mean to us? What does it mean for me as a woman who is born in Pakistan but raised elsewhere and goes home every year to see my country falling apart? I just came back 3 weeks ago. What does that mean to me? And what it means to me is that it's not about Islam. It's about the economic infrastructure, the criminals we put into place in government, and how we deal with the repercussions of bombs and blasts and civilian life. Here in this country, the wonderful thing you have is that every life matters. In my country, it's very different. And we have to change that. So I think we have to sort of start looking outside of this construction called religion. We have to start looking outside of that to become more human and perhaps more spiritual and religious.
Well, it is the eternal conundrum, right? You want to be more free and more human and more international and more cross-cultural and more borderless, but you're still Muslim or you're still Jewish. And it's kind of hard to be both at the same time, really. Let's face it. You do one or the other. It's like you're either playing golf or you're playing basketball. You can't play basketball and golf at the same time.
But you can play both well.
Separately.
Yes.
Right. Well, on that note, I think we all have to end this conversation. But it's been very interesting, and I'm sure our listeners will appreciate it. And we should come back to this discussion because it's a long one. It'll
Thank
be
you.
An ongoing dialogue.
Thank you, Jordan. I appreciate it. And thank you for what you've done.
Thank you for listening. It's been another edition of Radio Tabule, fresh content west of the Middle East. Please support the programs of Levantine Cultural Center with your contributions. Visit levantinecenter.org to learn more about how you can become involved. Radio Tabule, produced by Jordan El Grabli, Jan Reinhardt, and Frida Becker, with music from Omar Fidel, omarfidel.com.